session number 29566, Reel 15.
Let's spice it, Reel 15.
And this was the situation, really. You patrolled. It was a life of endless patrols. And as I've said before, patrols could last any length of time from 24 hours up to 6 weeks. Usually they were sort of 3 and 5 days affair, 5 day affairs, maybe a week. It was on odd occasions that platoons were sent out for a lot longer on particularly big operations where the military hierarchy had decided to concentrate on a particular area, and they would call in perhaps 2 or 3 battalions, you know, the Royal West Kents or the Queen's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, the Suffolks, and police jungle units, where they might have a large area that they wanted to concentrate on because they'd got very good and specific information about strong bandit formations within a particular area. You might only be in a holding situation where several companies were on the periphery of an area, and all you had to do was basically sit there day and night while another battalion swept through the area, or a police jungle squad swept through the area. You were just there in case anybody came out at your end. I mean, you might have a box situation where you would have three different battalions on a box, and another battalion either sweeping through an area or a police jungle squad sweeping through an area. But these were on particularly very, very large operations. But invariably, operations were of a fairly small nature.
And how common would it be that you would have an encounter?
You might go weeks and weeks and weeks, even months. You might get lucky. You might have 3 bumps in as many days. It all depends. You can't really say there was a hard and fast, if you go out, you're definitely going to hit something. I've known blokes who've never had a hit in their life.
Any other incidents that spring to mind during that period?
Well, not during that period, but I mean, we patrolling was just endless. And at that particular time, the battalion was fairly under strength. I mean, it had, bearing in mind that a normal battalion strength may be anything from 800, 900 to 1,000 men, we were down to just under 400. But as time went on, we were getting, I mean, national servicemen at that time were being drafted in an amazing rate. I think there was drafts coming, national servicemen were coming in at an unprecedented rate every other Thursday, I think it was. And I then, in about October 1950, the battalion was pulled out of the line, and the whole battalion was sent up to Penang, which was an island just off the coast of Malaya, bandit free, for R&R, which is retraining and recreation. And we went to a beautiful purpose-built barracks just outside Georgetown, where really it was back to the bullshit again, really, not like we did had experienced in basic training days, but you were properly dressed. You were still in jungle green, but you had, you know, jungle green shorts and your blouse, and you wore your webbing belt and your anklets and your berry and your all your flashes, and anybody that had any insignia, NCOs all wore their NCO signature, and officers went back to their Sam Browns and everything like that. And it was guard duty, retraining in a drill, shooting for more pay, but lots and lots of relaxation, loads of football, loads of cricket, nights out in Georgetown. And that was the only time, I think, where we didn't take our weapons everywhere. you could go into Georgetown and have a meal and go to the cinema. Lots of blokes visited women. It was 2 months of just relaxation and getting the battalion up to strength. I mean, drafts were joining us all the time, so we gradually built up the battalion strength, and we were almost up to strength by the end of October 1950. And then in January, I think it was, the battalion was told that it would be going back to its first hunting ground in South Selangor, to a place called Kajang. Now, Kajang was notorious for the Kajang gang, led by a very able, very guiley, murderous leader called Lu Kong Kim. He had a fearsome reputation, so much so that he, at one time, he drove around Kajang in an American Cadillac with a communist flag flying as a pennant. And everybody in Kajang lived in fear of this bloke. He was absolutely bloody ruthless. He would never ask twice, he'd just shoot anybody. And he laid several successful ambushes. He'd given the Scots Guards a bit of a rough time. And we took over from the Scots Guards. And, I mean, the Scots Guards had quite a reputation out there. They'd got themselves into a bit of trouble where they'd taken a lot of people under their wing, and I think some of them didn't quite make it. I won't put it any stronger than that, but there'd been lots of inquiries about the Scots Guards, but like all these inquiries in situations like this, you know, what can I say, it's war, these things happen. Anyway, I think it was on the 4th of December the battalion went back to Selangor. Headquarter company was based about 16 miles outside Kuala Lumpur, a place called Waldyburn Camp. A company went to Kajang. B company went to a place called Broga, which was renowned for its hills. It's very hilly in Broga. C company went to a place called Bukit Dara, and D company went to Dinkle. Now, Dinkle was quite well known for its swamps. It was just known as Dinkle Swamps. And it's near another place called Sepang, which for any motor enthusiast today is known as the Sepang Circuit. It's the where they hold the Malaysian Grand Prix, which it's amazing. When I see it on television now, it's just one mass of concrete. Well, when we were there, it was just one mass of bloody swamp. It was just swamp everywhere. Now, D Company at that time had a company commander called Major Leach. He was known as Ozzy. And to create a bit of interest, Ozzy called the whole company together one day and he said, and this comes back to what I was saying earlier, the relationship between officers and NCOs to the men in a operational situation as opposed to officers and NCOs in basic training. He said, look lads, he said, I'm going to offer a prize, he said. Everybody from today will grow a moustache. He said, all those people that got moustaches, shave them off. He said, and at the end of 2 months, he said, I'm going to give some leave out. He said, and we'll measure the moustaches and we'll have a panel of judges. And this went down like a bomb. You know, the blokes thought, bloody hell, this is great. You know, so everybody grew moustaches from little pencil moustaches. They were blokes, I mean, like myself. I could never grow anything on my lip at all. And there was blokes with handlebar moustaches and waxed ends. And the people that won, I think they got 4 days leave in KL. Well, you know, 4 days leave is fantastic. But this was what they did. There was none of this bawling and bloody shouting. It was everything to get the blokes interested, you know. And at that particular time, or just before that, my platoon officer, Joe Starling, and the other two from Deacon, they'd all finished their period of time in Malaya, and they'd come back to England, and they'd gone to the small arms training establishment at Warminster, I think it is. So we had different platoon commanders taking over different platoons. Now, there is a situation, certainly, or there was a situation in our battalion that rifle company platoons had nicknames. I can give you some examples, if you like, of the nicknames that our platoons had. In A Company, for example, one platoon was named the Hellraisers. Two platoon were known as the Carlsberg Kids. And three platoon were known as the Phantoms. I think because they used to come up on bandit camps from nowhere. B Company, four platoon were known as the Angels. Five platoon were known as the Fireside Kittens. Sixth platoon were known as the Kangaroos. C Company, 7th platoon was known as the Grave Diggers. 8th platoon were known as the Green Devils. 9th platoon were named the Nutters because we reckoned that all the bloody silly sods were in 9th platoon. They weren't silly, but they were all off their bloody rockers. D Company, 10th platoon was known as the Lady Killers because they shot more lady bandits than male bandits. 11th platoon were known as the Man Maulers, and 12th platoon were known as the Dogs. Now, throughout the battalion's tour of Malaya, the company platoons took on these names and sported their own emblems. They had they got the company artist to do all these lovely, weird and wonderful signs. Very similar to the signs that you saw on Super Fortress Super Fortresses during World War II on the fuselage, they had these lovely signs, and that they were on the camp notice board. Now, from time to time, the names did change. Although the ones that I've given you are the main ones, there were also references to 4 Platoon B Company being known as the Nomads, and 11 Platoon were known as the Hillmen or Roberts Raiders. Now, Roberts Raiders was because we had a Lieutenant Roberts took over a particular platoon. They used to change, but in the main, they were the names. And, I mean, the battalion magazine that was printed on site in there, they weren't referred to as 6th Platoon or 7th Platoon. It was always known as the Carlsberg Kids or the Dogs or whatever. They were always referred to by their nicknames, and everybody knew who they were talking about. Anyway, getting back to what I was saying before, those three platoon commanders of D Company all came back to the UK, and we were given new platoon commanders, and life went on much the same as it did before. I went back to Kajang with A Company, funnily enough, on detachment, because they used to pick out different people to go on detachment all over the place. So you had varied sort of situations. Anyway, it was a little while afterwards that the three officers in question, they'd finished their leave and their instruction in England, and they rejoined the battalion in Malaya. And at that time, we had just set up an intelligence room in the police station at Kajang. Although I was still on duty company patrols, they didn't have an intelligence officer. We had one in Sagama, but he was not a Suffolk. He was badged Suffolk, but I think he was Ordnance Corps, Captain Hook and Miller, but he'd gone back to his original unit. So the battalion was without a battalion intelligence officer. And Lieutenant Starling came back, and he was given the position of temporary IO at Kajang. And I was in Kajang. I had to go into the police station one day, and he spotted me, and he said to me, do you want a job? And I said, well, what is it, sir? So he said, do you want a transfer to the intelligence section? So, being like most blokes, wanted to get out of the jungle bashing, I said, oh, yes, please. So he said, well, you'll probably have to go on a course. He said, but I can arrange it if you want to join me at the intelligence in the intelligence battalion intelligence section at Kajang police station, which was just like a little old hut on stilts inside the police compound itself. We had one large Nissen hut on stilts, but it was all, you know, made out of bamboo and attap and all that sort of thing, and there was nothing there virtually. It was just an empty room. And he set this place up. He got maps, he got some hardboard and fibreboard, and we nailed all this stuff onto the wall. And we got maps of the area, and we put them up and covered them with coda trace. And we got coloured pencils, and we started pencilling in all where our various platoons and companies were in relation to where the headquarters were, where Kajang police station was. And by this time, they'd managed to, because of constant harassing, they'd gradually managed to get the Kajang gang to move out of the centre of Kajang itself. They'd driven them out. He was, although he was still pretty active. He'd ambushed the local railway, he'd cut the water line, he'd made a right bloody nuisance of himself. He'd killed a number of people in cold blood. He'd shot up the public works department. He'd killed the Tamil foreman. It was just indescribable. He just used to go in and kill everybody, this brother. Anyway, I joined Joe, and we had, by then we'd got a sergeant, another national service man, a corporal who came from duty company, Corporal Cox, and we got Mike Walker, who was a sergeant, and we formed quite a close little unit. And we all went on a shortened intelligence course. We had to learn two codes. One was called Linex, which was a little bit difficult. I was really glad, all the time I was in the intelligence section, we only ever got one coded message in Linex, because nobody understood Linex. I don't think even the people that bought it in understood Linex. But there was an easier one, where it changed daily. You had a series of cards with everything on this card that you were likely to encounter, like words like convoy, men, ammunition, everything that you could think of in a operational environment, so that when you sent a message to a patrol, you would say things like, instead of saying, for example, three vehicles will be at your location at 2 o'clock, it would read Uncle Charlie. And then the bloke at the other end he'd have the same reference thing as you. Uncle Charlie, on that particular day, on the chart, read three vehicles, or one 3-tonner and two 1,500 weights. It was a very, very simple code. But it covered up anything specific that you wanted to send. So we had to learn this. We had to learn how to read a map, and which is different from reading a map and doing compass readings actually in the field. You have to also be aware and how to read aerial photographs. The RAF took us for a week and showed us how to interpret aerial photographs. You had these double vision binocular things that they used to use Spitfires and Tempests, used to fly over the jungle and do aerial photography. They used to be developed, and they used to dish them out to all the battalions in all different areas, and you would be able to put that onto your map, and it would have things like suspected bandit camp and all these different references, and you could pinpoint on your map in the office. And then the CO would come down, or the 2IC, and he would hold a conference with the intelligence officer and probably the local police chief, and he'd say, right, I think today we'll send a patrol in there, or tomorrow, or whenever. Then you'd get, the patrol would come out from camp, which was probably 20 minutes up the road. Into the police yard would come, say, three 1,500 weight wagons with 25 blokes, all in jungle kit with all their gear and packs and guns and rifles, and they were fully armed to the teeth, looked like a load of bloody bandits themselves, except for the colour of the uniform. They were bristling, and the platoon commander and his sergeant would come into the operations room, and if the CO or 2IC wasn't there, the IO would explain the situation, where they wanted them to go, and the platoon commander would mark it on his map, because he had a map that corresponded to that area, and he'd say, okay, and the IO would say, we suggest you drop off at that particular point, because out there all the roads had mile signs, and it used to read like ninth mile or whatever. So he would say, we'll drop you off, we suggest you drop off at ninth mile and then work your way in from there and then go across. You would never go directly in. And that's what they used to do. And then the patrol would go out, and if they contacted anything, that obviously they'd make radio contact with base. We had a radio in the ops room. Sometimes they would come straight back to us because it was on the same frequency as the police frequency. We had a police lieutenant in there, British bloke, who used to operate the radio both for police patrols, and you could get on the same frequency, because when the signaller makes contact with base, he has to do what's known as a call sign. First of all, he will spend about 5 or 10 minutes making sure that he's on the same frequency or the correct frequency as base, and you could hear things like, he would say, Baker Charlie 1 calling base, Baker Charlie 1 calling base, Baker Charlie 1 calling base, report my signal, over. And then he will listen out until he gets a reply back from base, the same thing, base calling Charlie Baker 1, and he will twiddle his knob until he gets it right spot on, and then he knows he's on correct frequency, because it's so easy to just go off, particularly in a jungle situation where you've got everything all around you. I mean, the poor old signaller, he might have to string his bit of wire up a tree or try and get to the highest point. Sometimes it's very, very difficult for him. And then they will report, you know, we are now at VU 7896, and VU 7896 on the map, you can mark it. You can see exactly where he is. Because, like our maps, you've got a grid at the top, which might be U, and a grid down the side that might be V. And then they're numbered as well. So VU 8476 or something is a map reference, and you can pinpoint the patrol's exact position.
So you would follow the progress of the
patrol? You can follow the progress of a patrol. And then you might get lucky. You might hear something like Charlie Baker 1 calling base, have encountered bandit camp, 3 dead, you know, three dead, no casualties, and, you know, bringing them out to the nearest road or something like that.
With the aerial photographs, when you did the course on that, was that just to really familiarise you with the idea of what an aerial photograph looks like? And
yeah, I mean,
was?
They didn't go into too much depth. I mean,
you wouldn't be there to interpret that.
No. They would do all that for you, but you could see. It's amazing, actually, when you look at an aerial photograph, just ordinarily, you just see a mass of foliage, or perhaps a space. But when you get it under these, I'm not sure what they're called, these...
It's a huge magnifying glass.
Yeah, it's like, it's a double magnifying glass, and it comes into 3D. And you can actually see huts and you can actually see open spaces. I mean, in the latter part of the emergency. The bandits got so short of food that they tried to grow their own crops, and you could actually see these rice fields, or turnips or potatoes or whatever they tried to grow.